just wanna see the same things you can see. Understand the meaning on a new degree.
In this episode, I sat down with Bob, and it was wonderful to speak to him. We kind of knew each other very, very vaguely through End of Life Doula UK. And we'd only had one short conversation beforehand to set up the interview. So really, this was me discovering him and his experience. And he had a lot of really great insight from being a social worker and understanding safeguarding and bringing all of that sort of informed knowledge plus personal experiences. It's really interesting to speak to somebody who is older, who has seen how these shifts have changed throughout the last couple decades, because it might not feel like it, but really things have changed quite quickly in the world of death care, and it's just interesting to hear his perspective. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. I don't prepare for these interviews, so it's very off the cuff, and I just kind of enjoy talking to people who do the same sort of stuff. So if you are into this, please support Talking with Mortals in whatever way you can, whether that's financially buying one of the card decks that we sell through the Good Morning Society, or just sharing the content, liking it, engaging with it, in whatever way feels right to you. So I hope we can continue having more of these conversations. And if there's anybody you want to see me talk to, I don't think I'm that interesting, but there are lots of interesting people, then, you know, tag them. Bring me to their attention. I'm always happy to sit down and gab about life and death and kind of everything in between. So yeah, enjoy this, and thank you so much for watching.
Degree. Maybe that could happen when you're next to me. I just want to see the same things you can see.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
So we only have just met. We know each other kind of vaguely through End of Life Doula UK. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself however you want to, and we can take it from there.
Okay. I'm Bob. I live in Edinburgh. I retired 15 years ago. Previous to that, I was in social work. And in my early career in social work, I studied death and dying, read all the relevant books at the time, and did some work, a few cases related to bereavement, which was quite interesting. Then I didn't do very much more until I moved to Edinburgh and started to do voluntary work through a hospice. And that's where I picked up the idea of doula work. I'm involved with End of Life Doula. I've only done one doula case, but I also run death cafes.
Mm. Oh, I love death cafes. They're some of my favorite things. So what I want to start with that introduction, what brought you to doing social work and specializing in the way that you did? Was it something from your early life or just an interest that you had?
No, I knew I wanted to work with people, but I went to university not having a clue what I wanted to do at all. The only thing I knew I didn't want to do was what my father was pushing me into, which was merchant banking and anything that would make lots of money. So it was a sort of an anti-choice rather than a pro-choice, really. When my then wife moved to Leicester, I applied for a job, got a job as a trainee social worker, and it went from there. I don't quite know why I became interested in death. It was a long time ago, we're talking sort of 50 years ago. I think it was, again, I think I have what these days is known in kids as sort of basic oppositional syndrome. You know, if there was something that everyone was saying you shouldn't do, then I was likely to do it, and so on. And I noticed fairly early on that people found it difficult to talk about death and dying. And I thought, well, why is this? You know, it's part of life. You know, it's what we all do. It's what we all got to do. It's not easy, but not talking about it doesn't make it any easier. Mm. And so I sort of, as I say, sort of read some of the books, and they talked about the situations that people find themselves in, you know, the classics like somebody dies and neighbours cross the road rather than get into awkward conversations and all that sort of thing. And I just thought, this can't be right. So I say the studies, and I did a long essay on my social work course on a case that I came across. And it just thought about it a lot. And it was sort of arising from that, really. I didn't have any specific losses or anything. I mean, I went to my first funeral when I was 16, when my grandfather died. Mm. It wasn't a particularly sort of, you know, life-changing experience or anything, but it was just something that was there that happened.
Mm. Yeah, I understand what you mean, because I feel the same way. I don't want to say this, but I was a bit of a weird kid when it came to death. Like, one of the first careers that I wanted to do was to be a funeral director. It just fascinated me. Probably because I loved the Addams Family, and for some reason that seemed adjacent in some way. And My Girl was definitely a formative film for me, and that was based in a funeral home. But yeah, for me, it wasn't any singular moment. It just always kind of felt like it was there in the background, and just a knowledge that I carried that other people didn't seem to.
Yeah.
So, oh, that's interesting. How did that play out then? So was it just sort of something that you carried with you as you did your social work, or was it, I'm not familiar with the way social workers operate in England.
Well, in the UK, social work is a local authority service, you know, along with schools and a whole range of other things. And I was a social worker for a while, and then I went up through the management system, and so you move away from working with people directly from clients. So I sort of changed, and in fact later on, when I took up a specialism later on towards the end of my career, it was child protection, children safeguarding. Mm. So I was head of children safeguarding for a large local authority in the centre of England when I retired. And that meant ensuring that systems were in place. It wasn't actually direct work with children. It was ensuring systems were in place, advising head teachers, elected members, senior managers and so on about anything to do with safeguarding and children's safety, being involved in local area management committees, interagency stuff, all that sort of thing. Mm. Linking with central government and regional people on safeguarding issues. I think we had something like 275 schools in Leicestershire, so it was a big county. And you got all sorts of interesting things came up, you know, and just very busy.
Mm. As you're saying that, I'm thinking, because prior to this, we had a brief conversation but talking about the idea of when you receive a referral through End of Life Doula UK, that it's rarely just a straightforward, this person is nearing their end of life, and we just need a little bit of support, that there tends to be a lot of external things going on.
Oh, yes.
Not just. So... the idea of safeguarding a vulnerable people, of navigating the systems that are working or not working, there must be a lot of parallels that you see.
Well yes, and that's why I offered to Emma that I'd be happy to be a safeguarding lead for the organisation, because yes, I do. But as you say, it's there were two things there. One is taking referrals. Yes, it's never just simple. It's the end of life. Somebody's usually got, you know, two autistic children as well, or they've got a son who's a drug addict or sorts of other things. But yes, almost by definition, the people that we work with are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Or potentially vulnerable, whether that's to financial abuse, psychological, physical, not often sexual, but that's always has to be borne in mind. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it's something that we strongly encourage people to be aware of. I mean, we don't want people to be paranoid and see abuse under every stone, but to be aware of the possibility. And I think the organisation has it pretty well. So yes, there are those sorts of parallels.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I kind of noticed, the disconnect between the reality of working as a doula and the training that we receive is that obviously you can't train for every possible circumstance, but it tends to be the people that I've had referred are in a position where they don't have a care network around them, where they don't have friends and family that are there to support, that just need a little extra hand. It tends to be situations where that person is alone, is isolated, has other things going on in their life that needs to be addressed on top of the fact that they're facing end of life. So yeah, safeguarding is a massive part of what we do, isn't it?
Potentially, yes.
So since you've kind of been working around this field for so long, how would you say that you feel we as a culture, and you can use whatever you deem as a culture, so, you know, Western culture, UK, whatever, how has the mood or attitude towards death and dying and mortality shifted in your experience, or has it shifted at all?
Yes, it has. Not as much, perhaps, as I would like to have seen. I mean, as I say, when I first was aware of the issues 50 years ago, it was very difficult to talk about death and dying. And I can remember very vividly one referral we had from a local GP about a woman who was at the end of life. And I just said, well, you know, have you talked to her about this? Oh, my God, no, he said. I don't want to frighten her. I said, well, if we're going to work with her, I really think she has a right to know what the situation is. And within a couple of hours, she'd been whipped off into hospital so that we couldn't get nearer. The GP, amazingly then, the GP was so frightened of talking to this woman about the fact that she was dying that he wouldn't let us nearer. And that was an extreme example, but that was very much around. It is still around, but it is now more spoken about with things like the Death Cafe movement, which is unfortunately still very, very, very small. Mm. And the recent debate on assisted dying, both in England or in Westminster and in Scotland, where I am, I think has really woken people up to the fact of the end of life, and has made people more aware of the need of palliative care, which, as we all know, is grossly under-resourced. I mean, it's been known for 40 years that we're on what's called a demographic time bomb, an aging population, which I believe I first knew was going to peak. The number of over 80s was going to peak just on or around 2030. Mm. We've known about that for 30 years, but no government has really got to grips with it. So the numbers of frail elderly people has exponentially increased, and the resources haven't increased to meet it. And so there's been a considerable shortage in the resources. Hospices are failing, hospices are closing, hospices are not keeping up with the demand. But the assisted dying debate has woken people up to that issue. And it's got people saying, you know, we need more resources for palliative care, for end-of-life care. Whether that will happen is another question. But it is certainly the end-of-life issue is, I think, more in the public eye because of the assisted dying debate. But it's one thing that's in the public eye among 200 others that are pressing on people. So it's not as centre as perhaps we'd like it to be. But no, it has changed. But there's still, I think, still a long way to go. And I think the conversations still need to be had.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you with the assisted dying legislation that's been working its way through in the UK. And is currently being held up, unfortunately. But it's one of the few things that has recently given me a small amount of faith back into our government system, because the hearings, all of the work around it, I feel has been very measured, has been very respectful, has been done in a way that I feel like people are taking it very seriously. And it's a serious thing to think about. But also to remember that we're not doing it for the first time. There are plenty of countries that have had these laws place for decades. Mm. So it's not like it's a new thing.
And my own view, my expectation is that it will actually impact a very, very, very small percentage of the population. You know, what's the figure? 650,000 people a year die in the UK. I expect it won't affect as much as 1% of those people. It's not, you know, and people are saying, oh, well, you know, it'll be like death camps and people will be queuing up to be and have their lives ended. No, it'll be nothing like that. It'll be a very, very small number of people that will actually be affected.
Yeah. And when you look at the statistics in like Canada, for instance, it was a very, very small percentage of people who started to benefit from that new legislation. And even as they've opened it up to mental health reasoning, then it's still a tiny percentage of the amount of people who die. So Scotland is an interesting leader, I guess I can say, when it comes to these things. So I think it's this year that hydro cremation, there's all sorts of different words for it, but using water cremation is legal, which is fantastic.
Yeah. And there's a firm in Edinburgh who I believe does human composting, but I haven't actually looked into that yet. But it's something I'm interested in. I just love the idea of being part of the earth and having a tree growing out of me. You know, it would be just great.
That's my.
Or even carrots or parsnips. Who knows? You know,
That's the one. So when I think about that, it's legal in a bunch of states in America now, and I feel like it's every month a new one is taking it on board. But the human composting, I think I hope that is available for me when the time comes, because it just it resonates with me. I like the idea of natural burials and all of that, but something about just turning into a garden after a month or two seems really beautiful. I wanted to ask about your experience with death cafes, because I run a monthly one here in the city center of Manchester, which brings in an interesting demographic of people, like a huge mixture as you would expect in a city center. So please tell me about yours and your experience with it.
Well, I started getting on for 3 years ago now. I started looking around to see where to hold them. And I thought of a cafe because of a death cafe, and I couldn't really find a cafe where it would work. And so I turned to community centres. And we had a new community centre near me, down in New Haven, that had only just been going for about 18 months. They bought up a old Victorian primary school. So, you know, built in sort of 1840 or something like that, and a new school had just been provided, so they were getting going, and I approached them, and it was a bit uneasy at first, but then he said, yeah, go for it, and so I'm part of the offering, and I've been running a death cafe there. We started off with 4 a year, now it's 6 a year. Started off quite well. We had about 12-14 for the first 2 or 3. I also ran one in a local library. That worked all right, but I've tried a couple of other community centres that hasn't worked. Into another community centre, we had one person turn up. so she had the benefit of myself and my partner and the cake that my partner brought along. And I think it helped her individually, but it was a bit disappointing. But I've had generally anywhere between 6 and 12 people turn up. But I think I've just come across a new daily paper, online paper that's provided. The guy at the community centre told me about. And I'm going to put the next one in there and see if that helps. Because publicising is always an issue. How do you publicise? So I use a online thing called Nextdoor. I put my death cafes on the deathcafe.com website, which usually is, I get more from there than from anywhere else. I tried Eventbrite, and I think I got one interest from there. So I didn't bother with that anymore, because it's a bit of a hassle. But it's mostly word of mouth. People come along, or a couple of people I picked up. I went to another death cafe in the city, run by a spiritualist group, and picked up a couple of people from there who came to my death cafes after that. So
you poached
but
them.
Yeah, all sorts. Oh, there's plenty. Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be worried about that. There was all sorts of things discussed. Some really fascinating things. I've had a couple of people who have had recent bereavements and wanted to talk about and try to understand what goes on. But we focus on all sorts of things. The thing that comes up fairly often is legacy. Mm. You know, what I'm going to leave behind, how I'm going to do that, what's going to happen, what's going to happen to all my effects. Obviously we've talked about assisted dying when that was very much at the centre of things. A range of different things are discussed. And the things that we emphasise, because I go along the deathcafe.com guidelines, is that it has to be informal. Mm-hmm. It's always free, although we do encourage people to put a few pennies in the slot to go towards the coffee. And you can have fun, you can enjoy it. You know, if something comes up that's funny, then enjoy it. You know, feel free to laugh. And we do. We often have giggles and people, you know, breaking out into bouts of laughter over things, because there's always humour, even in the end of life, even in death. And that's fine. But the most important issue is having the conversation. I can remember one person who came along a couple of years ago. She was desperate to talk. She was in her 80s, about 83, perfectly fit, very healthy, but she was desperate to talk to her family about what was going to happen at the end of her life. And all she ever got was, "Oh, don't worry, Mum, you don't need to think about that. You know, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to know." And she was desperate. How do I do this? How do we? So I had a separate session with her and we talked through the options and so on. And eventually she did say that they had started to open up, but mainly because someone else in the family had just been diagnosed with a terminal cancer. So sort of focus their thinking a bit. That's I think the biggest value of death cafes is for people who want to talk about the issues, but can't get anyone else, friends, family, or think they're weird because they want to talk about what's going to happen at the end of their lives. And what's crucially is people understanding that there's a lot of preparation to do. And it helps to do a lot of preparation. Recently, I have a house down south and my next door neighbour looks after it for me. And a couple of weeks ago, her husband died. It was very expected. He was 94, so it wasn't a great shock or anything. Mm. And she said to me a few times, "Oh, I didn't realise how much there is to do." Yeah. Administratively, practically, you know, and she has no computer. She's got no access to the internet. But fortunately, she's got a daughter-in-law who helps out, and she's applying for all sorts of things, closing down things, the will, and all the rest of it, and she's now got to apply for pension credit in her own right, and so many things to think about. And of course, it's at a time when people emotionally are not in the best state to be working through things, and that's why people need doulas, that's why people need help at the end of life, but preferably to have planned beforehand. And that's one thing people find very difficult to think about doing. Some people are brilliant at it, some people are not. Some people, oh well, you know, it'll happen when it happens and we'll sort it out then.
Yeah,
but one of the things I say to people is, you know, if you're going to get married, you should do quite a lot of planning over a number of months and you get everything in place for the wedding day. If you're gonna have a baby, you've got 9 months to plan. You do a lot of planning, you do a lot of buying, you do a lot of sorting out room decoration, whatever. Dying's the same. There's a lot of things that it helps to have planned for and to have prepared for, whether it's principally for the benefit of surviving relatives who've got to sort things out.
Yeah absolutely. The amount, the sheer amount of admin and paperwork that's involved at a time when chemically your brain just is not functioning the way that it did before. It does not operate It's yeah, I think emotionally some people can't engage in that topic, but if you come at it from a practical point of view, which is why I think many doulas, when we go through our training, we sort of attach ourselves to advanced care planning because we're like, well, this is a practical thing. This is the thing that does need to happen. And you can approach much of it in a non-emotional way, in a more matter-of-fact way that people who are a bit more death phobic, I think, can access. And then hopefully you can get to a more emotional place. But yeah, that's one of the main things that brought me to being a doula was after my dad died suddenly, it felt like there should be somebody there to be like, okay, well, this is what you do next. And this is who you need to call. And in this case, go over here. It felt like to me that it was just this horrible scavenger hunt that I would go and speak to somebody and they'd be like, oh, well, I think I know somebody. And then I'd have to chase around. It's just having a doula there for lots of reasons, but even just for the practical guidance of saying, okay, you're going to need the death certificate for this and make sure you get a couple of copies because you'll need them for various things that you won't expect. And yeah, it's one of the invaluable things that we can offer people. But yeah, the death cafes, I think, are spaces where people can engage in that long, long, long before they have to. So they are a bit more emotionally prepared.
The last one we did, a couple of weeks ago, very interestingly, one of the things we talked about was the practical tasks that need doing at the end of life and why we don't get around to doing them, what the blockages are that stop us doing it. Because I've said, you know, I did my will last year and I need to do a letter of wishes. It'll be a very brief, very simple thing, but I just haven't got around to doing it. And thinking through it, why you haven't, you know, is it any sort of psychological block? Is it because I'm lazy or is it because there's always something I'd rather be doing, you know, and it's probably the latter. But this other guy who's there said, I've done the will. I know I need to do a power of attorney. And one of my executors is encouraging me to do a power of attorney, but I can't bring myself to do it. And he said, I think it's independent, it's letting go my independence. So he thought it through. He knew why he was finding it difficult to do, but he was definitely finding it difficult to do. And then we talked about other reasons, and there's one, a couple of people there who are very keen to set up some sessions for people on getting the written work done. Some practical homework sessions, if you like. So I think the idea is they'll talk for a bit and then say that's enough talking, sit down, do the work now, and then get back together again. And it's a brilliant idea. I'm not going to be involved in that. They said, oh, do you mind if we do that? I said, absolutely fine, you do it. That sounds a brilliant idea. For you know, it's linked to the death cafe, but it's not, you know, I don't own the death cafe. It's I don't own talking about death. If you want to do something practical and helpful, absolutely wonderful. It's, you know, great.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. I think so. I have ADHD, and I do. It's called body doubling. It's essentially like you're just with somebody to get that task done. For some reason, it works. So yeah, that's a brilliant idea. I admit that I've really struggled with the idea of sitting down and creating those forms of putting my wishes down. One of the ways that I've kind of, I don't know if I've tricked myself, but one of the things that we who work around death and people who are dying, I think universally experience is the idea that, how do I put it? Life is precious. Life is this special thing, and confronting your mortality doesn't make you necessarily scared to die, but it allows you to see how precious every moment is, that things aren't promised to you. So there's almost a universal appreciation and gratitude that I find in people who do this work. So when it comes to me thinking about putting my wishes in place, it's less about giving up that control and more about affirming, this is who I am, this is the life that I like, these are the things that I love about life, And it's more life affirming than thinking about, okay, well, if I'm incapacitated, then this is what is going to happen. Kind of coming from a different point of view. And I think for a lot of people, especially parents, people who are career driven, you lose sight of the things that you love about life because you're just so busy, because you have other priorities. Mm. And it's a way to sort of reclaim that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Sure.
So one of the other things, we've kind of talked about it a little bit here and there, but I know that you feel quite strongly about the medically assisted dying legislation and everything that's going through. I don't know if you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I first became interested in it, as with many people, the personal experience. My mother died 12 years ago now, but at the end of her life, she was into her 90s. She had to go into a care home at the end because she kept falling over, and my sister, who lived nearby, would have the responsibility constantly of having to go around at 2-3 o'clock in the morning when the mother fell over, and she was becoming incontinent. So she felt she, you know, got no dignity, and she just wanted to end it. She said, "I don't want to be here anymore." She was mentally alert. You know, there was no sort of hint of dementia or anything, but she was very physically frail, and she just said, "I don't want to be here anymore." And she actually asked me to help her to die. And I said, "Mum, you know I can't do that." And she stopped eating. It's what we now call VSED, voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And she just stopped eating and drinking and took 2.5 weeks to die. That's not a unique experience. I've heard other people talk of similar things. And it made me think, surely there should be some way in which my mother should have been able to make a positive choice. Mm-hmm. Rather than having to starve herself to death in a situation where she was psychologically in pain. She wasn't in any physical pain. She didn't have a diagnosis. So first off, she wouldn't qualify in any country, or possibly now in Canada she might, but she wouldn't qualify in any country, and certainly not in England and Wales or Scotland, for assisted dying, because she hasn't got a diagnosis. She just wanted to end her life. But it brought home to me one element of the many elements there are in assisted dying, and that's the issue of personal choice. And obviously, you know, suicide is not a crime. People can commit suicide. People do commit suicide. My mother didn't have the capacity to do so. And she probably wouldn't have seen it as committing suicide. She just, as she's put it, didn't want to be here anymore. Mm. She'd lost interest in everything. She'd lost interest in her large number of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She no longer had the television on. And having known my mother as long as I did, there wasn't a moment she was awake when the television wasn't on. But although there was a television in her room, in the care home, the nursing home, it was never on. She just wasn't interested. So, you know, for her, she would say there was no point in her being here anymore. So as I say, that's one issue. And then obviously there's lots and lots of other issues where cultural things come in, religious things come in, spiritual things come in, practical things. And I thought about it an awful lot. And I wasn't pro assisted dying. I was pro having the discussion. That there should be a sensible, intelligent discussion about it. And I don't remember who I said it to. I may have said it to Emma. I said, if at the end of the day the result is that there isn't assisted dying, that's fine, as long as there has been the conversation, as long as we've thought about it as a society and reached a conclusion. And in fact, I understand, I didn't hear any of it, but I understand that the first debate in the House of Lords was actually one of the best discussions and debates they'd had in that chamber for many, many years on any subject. It was reasoned, it was rational, lots of people bringing in their own personal experiences. And for me, that's, you know, whoopee, it's great, they've had the conversation. I think we will end up with assisted dying, although, as I said earlier, I think it will affect a very small number of people. And it will be a small part. But what bugged me about it is people using, people disingenuously using arguments which are not their real reason for opposing it. You know, like that. And there's one politician who I have a great deal of time for, who has said that we shouldn't have assisted dying because we should put resources into palliative care. And to me, that's totally disingenuous. Yes, we need resources into palliative care, but it's not an either or. Yeah. There are still, however much palliative care we have, there are still some people who, for whom assisted dying would be the right outing. And I think he was actually, his real opposition was on religious grounds, but he didn't want to say that. So he used the palliative care thing, and I said, you know, that's like saying, you know, we shouldn't have cancer care because we need better dental care.
Yeah,
it made as much logical sense to me as that.
So
there have been all sorts of things like that, but the parallel I came up with, which other people have as well, is with the debates about rights to abortion rights, which was sort of what 20 getting on for 30 years ago, with many of the same sorts of things, you know, sanctity of life, individual choice, and, you know, a range of other issues, which are very, very similar. And if people think of it in the same way, what won out in the end was individual choice. I still have, I mean, I'm not pro or anti-abortion. I'm very strongly in favour of people having a right to determine their own lives. But there's a little bit of me that thinks, well, it is a shame that all those potential lives are destroyed in the abortion process. And, you know, I read quite a lot of books of the what if approach, you know, it's alternative realities, you know, and how many of those aborted children might have become another Mozart or, or another Caravaggio or however you want to put it. So it's not an absolute, and many things in human relationships and human life are not absolutes. And in the same way, my view on personal choice is strong, but again, I'm not going to say it's an absolute, because there may be people might say, well, this person, okay, they want to die, but what about the effects on other people near them? You know, unfortunately, life is not simple. There are politicians and there are headline writers who would like to think that it is, that it's either a yes or a no, an either or an or. And life's often not like that. There's an awful lot of are but and what if and yes buts in life issues. And assisted dying is one of them.
Yeah, it really is. And it's not lost on me the connection between abortion rights and, you know, the right to die, especially in America. I'm not sure so much over here. The same groups that oppose both.
Because of the sanctity of life.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an interesting thought process, because obviously people have talked about abortion, like, when does life start? At what point is it considered a human life? Is it at birth? Is it the first breath? Is it heartbeat? Is it brain activity? What is that? And on the flip side, you talk about dying with dignity, and you hear a lot of people, when you think about, like, what people fear about end of life. And it's that loss of dignity. It's that feeling like you're no longer yourself, that you have no control over your body, that you aren't fully living. So the idea being, like, well, what's your definition of, are you still alive? Are you still a living person? Are you happy with the life that you were living? And at what point do you draw the line for yourself when it comes to that? And one of the things with medically assisted dying that is an extremely tricky caveat, obviously in countries that have this legalized, there is the idea of capacity. So even when we're drawing up our advanced care plans, there's an element of, do you have the capacity to be making these decisions?
Absolutely.
And one of my biggest fears is Alzheimer's. I've had a lot of people in my family with dementia. That's not something that I want for myself, but the idea you cannot plan ahead for your medically assisted death in the case of having dementia, but by the time you are diagnosed with dementia, then you no longer have capacity. So yeah, it's definitely, life is not simple. Life is not clean cut, even though we try to make it. But I agree. I think at the end of the day, if this doesn't go through, I do feel mostly satisfied that it has been discussed properly, and maybe it's just not the right time. But I also do fear, I agree with you with the argument about palliative and hospice funding. That needs to happen regardless of whether this legislation goes through. And there are people who are suffering right this second that would not be in the same place if we did have that funding in place. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So I guess this is a good segue into a question that I like to ask. If you had a magic wand and you could just sort of wave it and change something in this landscape, whatever that may be, what would you change?
Well, one thing I would like to see is that death and dying becomes part of the school curriculum. You know, it's not too early to think about life, and that it may be that in some ways, in some schools, it is included, because of course there are schools that have life skills and human relationships and so on. But I was very much struck by, I don't know if you know, Marie Curie Research does a webcast every year. And in fact, there's one coming up, I think it's probably next week. And I did the last one two years ago. And there was an excellent presentation from Northern Ireland where they had gone into schools and they called it action research and had helped teachers to learn how to talk about end of life. And the results were stunning in that they did a check on, you know, how confident are you to talk to a child about if the child has a death in the family? And it started off, you know, sort of 23%. Then they did the training, and then they did the same questionnaire again, and the figures were up to 73-75%. So the teachers were a lot more confident. But the figures they came up with, I think it's something like in the average primary school, I'll keep talking, although it looks if you may have gone. In the average primary school, one in 29 children were likely to have had a recent bereavement, a reasonably close bereavement, friend, brother, grandparent, parent, whatever, which means in every class there's likely to be a child who's had a recent bereavement. And when I've said that to people, people are amazed. Well, that's an awful lot. Yes, it is. It's, you know, it's a normal part of life. And if schools shy away from it, then children will know that it's not a safe subject and they won't talk about it. And so children need to know that it's a safe subject if you want to talk about it. So that's why I think we should be talking in schools. Again, I always emphasize not to talk about it and obsess about it, but have it as part of the normal language, the normal interaction, the normal curriculum, so that any child whose, you know, grandfather dies or mother dies or best friend dies feels there's someone that they can go and talk to and say, you know, this has happened and what do I do and whatever.
Yeah.
Again, just as part of life, not as an exceptional event.
Yeah, that would be beautiful. And it needs to start somewhere. It needs to start, you know, from, and not like, you know, a generational thing, but as teachers do that, the children will learn, they will bring it home to their parents will get more comfortable with it. And it's just sort of this growing movement, that honestly,
well, you hope so. There'll be two parents. What the hell are you talking to my child about that for?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You can't talk to my child about real life, you know.
But I'm always struck by the idea that this is, it's something that a couple hundred years ago, the idea of educating children about it, it wouldn't even be a thought, because we did live with death and dying and grief and all of
it. There was a lot more. Yeah.
So
yeah,
it shows how far removed we are.
In a family of 11 children, three of them might reach adulthood in some situations. So, yeah, a lot of children grew up with death around them, and it was normal. It's become abnormal in the 20th century, and that's why it's necessary to have the discussion.
Mm. Yeah, and I think people, for whatever reason, because it's been removed from our life experience, there's this feeling that we're not capable of dealing with it, that it's something that it's too hard, and that's why it's been put behind walls and doors. And it's simply not true. I think we are obviously going to be devastated, and it is one of the most difficult things that you go through in your life, but it is a natural part of life, and the only way to experience it is to experience it and learn from it. One of my absolute idols, Stephen Jenkinson, who's a death worker in Canada, he talks about the idea that a fully formed human is one that lives with grief, that has experienced death of somebody close to them. And I really, really believe that. I think it's part of the human experience. And if you haven't had that, then you aren't a fully formed human yet. So yeah, get them young. Let's teach them young. And I know, I'm not sure what it is in Scotland. In England, the curriculum is changing. I'm not sure at what age, but they are starting to teach bereavement in classrooms, which is great. I think it's a good start.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I wish I could give you that wand, because that would be a wonderful thing to change.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay. We are drawing to a close here, but I just wanted to give you the opportunity if there's anything else that you wanted to bring up that I didn't get to ask you, or any thoughts that have come up.
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered quite a bit.
I feel as if
I should choose some bits of music for my desert island now, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love that podcast. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time and your perspective. It's wonderful to talk to you. And thank you again.
It's good to talk to you. And I hope I'll come across you again at doula events.
I just want to see the same things you can see. Understand the meaning on a new degree. Maybe that could happen when you're next to me. I just wanna see